Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, today we've got an all-important update to make. This is kind of big news for us, right? Because we talked about the previous iteation of this. Boy, what was it now? Like almost 4 years ago. Or no, 3.5 years ago.
In October 2009, our October 8th episode specifically, you and I talked about a concept called the Volkswagen L1.
Yeah, and we both, if I recall right, I think we both really, really liked this car a lot. I know I did.
Yes. We had quite a fanboy episode that day, Scott, because, you know, we love a good concept car. This car was particularly important because the idea was that Volkswagen was going to build a vehicle that could go 100 kilometers on 1 liter of diesel.
Okay, and now we're going to update this. We've got, we've done some Facebooking on this and and just mentioning this otherwise. But I tell you, this whole vehicle from start to finish has excited me from the very beginning. I mean, back in 2002 when it first emerged, then I think in 2008 or 9 is when it kind of came about again. You know, the idea came up again, and then now here we are in 2013. And it's a reality, which is really, really cool for something like this to have such a long, you know, progression, such a long lead up and actually make it, because there was a lot holding this one back when we talked about it the first time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For example, this had a couple of issues. Mainly, there were affordability issues for carbon fiber, one of the materials used in the production of the original L1.
Yeah, so now when we get to this one, the XL1, which is the honest-to-goodness production version of the Volkswagen that we're talking about, the carbon fiber issues, Ben, this is so surprising to me. I'm shocked. My eyes are wide open at that. You know, I'm even reading this. Carbon fiber technology for production automobiles is now a reality, which is really, really cool, because even just a few years ago, it wasn't. It was so far away from reality that, you know, it was being used only in sports cars, only in low productions, you know, because, I mean, just to give you an idea, you know, the resins and the layers of materials that had to be laid together, you know, it's called hand-laid carbon fiber is usually the way they refer to it. That's not the case with how they do it now, in this vehicle specifically, but it just wasn't even a possibility. It just took so many man hours to put together even one panel for a car.
Yes.
That now, you know, to imagine that they're going to build this entire vehicle with carbon resin, I think is what they use, right?
Yeah, it's a polymer. So this is a little bit different. The original L1 was just using carbon fiber reinforced body. So that's CFRB. But the XL1 has taken that a step up, and they've got carbon fiber everywhere. The seats are carbon fiber.
Yeah, the chassis carbon fiber.
Yeah. Know,
which is really, really cool.
Surprising.
Now, it's a monocoque design, which is, comes from racing, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's like a safety cell. We've seen that in, the smart vehicles, but it's a different type of material. The safety cell is more like a racing technology. Again, it's molded in one piece using what they call rapid resin transfer process. Mm-hmm. And I know nothing about it because they've had a press release where they say, you know, here's how we're doing it. What's exciting is that they're able to, in some manner, mass produce these things, although it will be a limited run to begin with. They are admitting that it's kind of a low production number.
Vehicle. They refer to them as examples in the marketing. Yeah, they say that we'll have fairly low number of examples.
Can we do something here? I mean, I want to interrupt this whole flow here of, you know, we're talking about the brand new vehicle. Let's, just for a moment, I want to go back and just kind of reminisce about the old version, because I was a huge fan of the original design, the original kind of olive green looking vehicle. It had a cigar shape to it, maybe, is the best way to describe it.
This is one of the questions I had for you for this podcast. What do you think of the new design? So let's talk about the old design first, and then get to the new design.
Yeah, sure. I'm probably jumping way ahead here.
No, this is perfect. So the old design did have some significant differences. Scott, for me, one of the significant differences was the interior, the tandem seats.
Yeah, oh, man.
They've changed.
I'll tell you, there's First, let me say this before we start this whole thing, because I'm not putting down the new one, the new XL1.
Okay.
I probably prefer the design of the original 1 liter car to the new design, I think. Mm-hmm. There's so many elements of the original design that I really loved. It had that, had the glass canopy that completely opened up.
That was super cool.
As a single piece, which there's some of that still there. Don't get me wrong. The shape of it was very, very narrow with the tandem seats that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's very few cars that have tandem seats. I mean, the Messerschmitts had them, you know, the micro cars.
Yeah.
I think that there's a vehicle called a Tango that has one. It looks like, this one looks like a deck of cards on end.
Right.
Really, really tall and narrow, but it's surprisingly like a performance car, which is strange. The tandem seating I thought was really super cool in this thing. The other thing is that the back end, it pinched down almost into a, not a point, kind of it had a blunt end on it, but nothing like what the modern one has. I mean, it's similar shape, but it's much, much wider.
They sort of mainstreamed the design for the XL1.
Yeah, and I know they had to. I mean, but when you look at some of the original photos of the 1 liter car, mm-hmm. It's just a gorgeous design to me. I mean, I really, really liked it. And I don't know if it was just that it was so simple, so microcar-esque, you know.
Yeah, it's simple. It's also aerodynamic, and it's a little bit of a performance vehicle, or reminds me of some of those experimental vehicles mm-hmm. that you'll see occasionally breaking, you know, world solar power records, solar power speed records, excuse me. And unfortunately, as we know, when vehicles move from concept to production, they have to change quite a few things, typically.
Yeah, but here's the good news.
What's the good news?
They didn't change it a whole lot. I mean, it's still essentially, it's if you look at it, you know, the original version to the version that we see today, the 2014 or whatever year it's going to be.
Right.
They haven't really said yet. It's still recognizable as being the Volkswagen 1 liter car. Even though they call it something different, it's the XL1, and you know, it's a little more refined, as you put it, I think.
Right. Yeah. There are some differences. For instance, if we return to the seats, now the XL1 has staggered seats. Why does it have staggered seats? Great question. The shotgun seat, I'll go ahead and call it the shotgun seat. Mm-hmm. The shotgun seat is slightly behind the driver's seat, and there's a good reason for this. Both the L1 and the XL1 use cameras in place of side view or rear view mirrors, and they have monitors in the doorways, or in the door, excuse me, mm-hmm. That would replace the side view mirror totally. So I could see how if you're in a tandem seating arrangement and you're trying to see the right hand monitor, that it could be difficult depending on who's sitting with you.
I guess that could be true. I mean, I'm just such a fan of like that. I thought it was so cool that, you know, they would have something that was so modern yet had some of these throwback elements in it like that. I just thought that was really kind of neat. I understand the canopy. I mean, I guess we should just go ahead and say it. I mean, I'm going to kind of go through the new one here, but, you know, looking at some of the press photos that have come out of the new version, I mean, you know, I said it's very recognizable, has full fender skirts in the back.
Yeah.
So it's totally covered. There's a, you know, most of the front wheels covered in a flat disc, mm-hmm. For aerodynamics again. You mentioned that it has cameras, so there's no rear view mirrors anywhere on this thing. There's no rear glass, which is another odd feature of this thing, because there's no need, I guess.
It
saves weight, and that's the area that the engine is located in. It does have gull-wing doors.
I was waiting to say this.
I love this. This is
really
cool.
If it had not had a canopy before, I would be over the moon, Scott. The gull-wing doors are awesome, though, because it's sort of a nod to a sports car element. Or it is a sports car element.
Certainly a sports car element. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, from, you know, if you're talking about a race car on a track, or you're talking about an old DeLorean, of course, you have to think of that. These are a little bit different. They pivot in two places on the, it looks like in the hood and, I mean, sorry, at the base of the windshield and on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got a 2-point latch system, I guess. I don't know, just a really cool, it's a neat design. I mean, you can just see it's very simplistic, very, very
minimalist,
austere, and it's, in the way they've done it. Now, you mentioned you like the seating in the previous one also. It almost looked like, sort of, I hate to say it this way, Ben, but it looked like lawn chairs almost. It had a little bit of padding wrapped on them.
Yes,
you
true.
Think of the mesh seats that a lot of office chairs have now. That's sort of what you're going to get in this vehicle as well. I mean, it's all about weight savings.
Yeah, it's still a Hypermiler's car, which is pretty neat. Do you want to talk about the engine briefly?
Yeah, let's mention that. And I've got kind of a list of, I've got a few different things. I've got a bunch of numbers here, which may or may not come into play, but I've got numbers on hand if we need them.
Great.
I've also got just some features that I think we should list before we get to the end of this, because the features, some of these have changed, some of them are new, some of them are kind of new technology and exciting. I think we should just mention all this in this update.
So. Okay, and the story, there's a pretty interesting story about how the XL1 was revealed to the world. Did you hear about this?
No, I didn't.
It was revealed to the world, not originally, I think, in Qatar, but Qatar was one of the places where the XL1 was being marketed. And that's kind of strange if you think about it, because Qatar has such a cheap gas price, the whole country. You
well,
know?
Yeah, of course.
So Qatar wouldn't be the intuitive pick or the intuitive market for a vehicle like the XL1.
Wait, okay. If I'm not mistaken, isn't Qatar, that's sort of a place where there's an excess of luxury vehicles, right? I mean, isn't
right.
this like very opulent? Everybody has, you know, well, not everybody, but a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of gold-plated Rolls Royces cruising around, a lot of
you
Lamborghinis, a lot of vehicles, you know, exotic
exactly.
cars, right?
Yeah, okay, here we go. You're going to like this. So
okay.
The XL1 has a debut at the first ever Qatar Auto Show. And it's examined by the country's prime minister, the minister of foreign affairs, a member of the ruling family. The visitors liked it, but they soon turned their attention into, from this article I'm reading, they soon turned their attention to the Touareg Gold Edition, which was, get this, an exercise in 24-carat excess. So
oh,
exactly
boy.
What you said. He
okay.
called it, man. So here's the thing. 17% of Volkswagen is owned by Qatar Holdings.
Okay.
So
let me
there's a vested interest.
But here's another little twist on this, right?
What's that?
This is a hybrid.
Yes,
and
that's
which
what
is,
we should mention.
Which is kind of crazy. So why would they reveal this vehicle in Qatar when that is kind of like an oil-rich society, you know, like where that's kind of it's a simple thing to go, you know, drive up and fill up your giant gold-plated SUV for you know, $10 or whatever the equivalent would be, because it's super cheap. And here they are revealing Volkswagen's revealing a hybrid vehicle that is, you know, it's marketed as a hyper-efficient vehicle, right?
Yeah, and as we're going to see, it more than matches the hype. But I just thought that was an interesting thing, because what a place for it to debut in Qatar. Now, of course, as car fans, we can both assure the listeners that Qatar has some amazing vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Just on the street, man.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah. So we'll see. Maybe the XL1 will catch on. I don't know. But when it does catch on, people will save a lot of money, regardless of how much you pay for gas, because the hybrid system is pretty smart. I'm going to say it's pretty smart. It's not the most impressive engine, maybe, in terms of performance. It's only got 47 horsepower. It's a two-cylinder. A lot of people probably just decided not to buy one.
A two-cylinder engine, which is amazing. But now think about this, though. It's got 47 horsepower, two cylinders. It's a turbo diesel, right?
Mm-hmm.
It also has a backup of an electric motor, you know, because the hybrid system that we talked about. 27 horsepower electric motor, right?
Yeah.
Man, this is incredible. The European combined fuel consumption for this vehicle. Now, this is like the MPG rating, I guess, for this vehicle. The combined fuel rating, 261 miles per gallon.
261 miles per gallon, which is amazing when you consider that this has a 2.6-gallon diesel tank.
Yeah, and it exceeded what they initially wanted, because when they called this a 1-liter car,
mm-hmm.
the original goal was to be able to travel
100 kilometers.
100 kilometers on 1 liter. So if you kind of work this out, you know, on paper and figure out the 261, that equals 0.9 of a liter for 100 kilometers. So the 1-liter car dream has been achieved, which is remarkable.
And it's been surpassed, really. Now, it's interesting because in our earlier show, before we did the update, we spoke about Ferdinand Piëch. The expert who drove the first concept and came up with the idea. Now,
he was chairman of the board at the time, mm-hmm. and I think he drove this vehicle right to his retirement.
Yeah, to Hamburg, from Wolfsburg to Hamburg. And this is a fact that we mentioned in the previous podcast. He had an average speed of 43.5 miles per hour, but he got 317.4 miles per gallon by his measure.
Wow, incredible.
Which is neat, but... Okay. They were thinking about making some changes here. It's just really cool to me because Ferdinand Piëch is on record saying some things about their plans for the XL1, and to have actually exceeded these numbers is just astonishing now, from an engineering perspective.
Now, when you said you probably convinced a lot of people not to buy it when you said it's a 47-horsepower two-cylinder engine, you gotta really put yourself in the mindset that this car is so lightweight and so small and so slippery and so... And we'll go through this in just a moment.
Yes.
We're nearing the end here, but it required... Now, this is a fact you read in a lot of these because it came from Volkswagen in the press release.
Mm-hmm.
This car is so slippery in design. Its drag coefficient, its resistance in the air is so low. It's
0.19.
Yeah, 0.19 right? is a drag coefficient, which is that's like do you remember the car, the Aptera hybrid?
Yeah,
I think it was somewhere around there as well.
Oh, cool.
Is super slick design, really really smooth. Again, no mirrors, no anything.
Mm-hmm.
Low weight. It requires this Volkswagen says it requires just 8.3 horsepower. To cruise at a constant 62 miles per hour. So you've got 47 horsepower on tap.
Mm-hmm.
It only requires 8.3 horsepower to maintain 62 miles per hour. Now that's, you know, you need more to get up to that speed, but just to maintain it at highway speeds. And, you know, if you're worried about top end.
Oh, yeah, this is interesting. They limited the top end.
Yeah, the top end, but... However, I mean, you would think that, like, okay, it takes... Oh, here's another little fact before I get to the top speed,
okay.
But it takes about 12.7 seconds to get up to that 62 miles per hour. So mm-hmm. it's kind of slow.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can expect that from something like this. It's not overly powered. It doesn't have a giant engine. It's not going for performance. It's
right.
all about
Absolutely.
Fuel efficiency. It's electronically limited to 99 miles per hour. So you can... Definitely cruise with the big boys on the highway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're able to go 99, if you need to, it's just that you're not going to be able to pass with a lot of speed or you're not be able to get up to speed that quickly. So be careful when you're pulling out in traffic in this thing.
And you said you had 12.7 seconds for the 0-60?
Correct.
So here's something that is a little bit different. This is perhaps one of the larger differences between the L1 concept and the XL1 production car is that the L1 was claimed to weigh about 840 pounds.
Oh, I'm glad you're mentioning weight right now.
And the XL1, people are saying 1,800 pounds?
Yeah, it's the actual official weight from Volkswagen is 1,753 pounds. Now, okay, I've got a little bit of not a story behind this, but this is, okay, the original was somewhere around 840, right?
Right.
This is 1,753, so we're talking about a significant gain in weight of 900 pounds. It gained more than doubled.
It's more than two cars. It doubled
its weight.
Yeah.
The reason, Ben, is that there's a lot of additional safety equipment and, you know, extra materials that they had to do.
Ah.
And being that this is a production version, they had to use materials that they could easily reproduce, you know, many of and quickly, relatively quickly, I should say, versus like the L1 concept. That they were able to build in a specialty shop, and each piece was, you know, hand formed and
layered.
Exactly, yeah. So it's slightly different in that way, but I mean, man, a 900 pound increase—that's incredible. However, consider this though: it's still a two-passenger vehicle that's only 1,753 pounds. That's an extremely lightweight car. As you know, you can see by the small engine that they need required to power it. I've got some of the exterior dimensions of this thing.
Yeah,
I'll give you an idea of the size.
Give people about. Let's do a height and a length.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. There's more about weight that I want to get back to. So
okay.
Let's do the height and length. So the length of this thing, it's 12 feet 9 inches long. It's about five and a half feet wide.
Mm.
But here's the crazy thing: the height. It's only 3 feet 9.5 inches tall. And if you want just something to, you know, quickly reference out on the street, think about it. The current Porsche Boxster, it's about 5 inches lower than the current Porsche Boxster. So it's a very, very low car.
You don't want to be topping out at 99 miles per hour and hit a pothole in this car.
No. But three feet, 9.5 inches tall, that's still pretty low. That's really, you're down low, and that's got to be kind of a cool feeling to drive. That alone, I totally appreciate, because you know I'd like to be as low as possible in my car.
Right.
I would prefer to lay down and drive my car if I could.
That you
would
want
be
a
great.
Recumbent car?
I like to reach out the window and touch the ground with my hand. Without having to bend over. That's the height goal.
Okay.
Anyway, okay. So we're back to weight.
Yes, we're back to weight.
Okay, so 1,753 pounds. Sounds like, you know, well, they doubled it, more than doubled it. That's a lot of weight, right?
Sounds like a lot to push.
Think about this. The current Mazda Miata, everybody can kind of gauge the size of that. I'm sure everybody's seen one by now. The current MX-5 model that, you know, started in 2005, the third gen, that weighs 2,500 pounds. So we're talking about, 800-pound difference there. So it's 800 pounds lighter than a Miata.
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way.
Yes.
Can I just mention this?
Yeah.
There's a fourth generation of Mazda Miata on its way soon. Which, I don't know why I hadn't even thought about this up until now, but I think it was, the Fiat group and Mazda are building a fourth generation Miata for Mazda, and Alfa Romeo, I think, is going to be the other manufacturer that's going to have this on their lots.
Interesting.
So that's on the way. Anyway, that's like 2014. And one last thing I want to mention about weight. So we've dispelled the idea that it's a heavy car, because it's not really heavy.
Right.
It's
just seems heavy in comparison to the concept car.
Yeah.
And the materials that have to be used for a production car are different.
And I'm telling you, like, they even did things like they gave it lightweight glass. There's like an ultra lightweight windshield that they've put in place. There's
low rolling resistance tires.
Yeah, polycarbonate side windows. And if you notice, the side windows are the kind that have a segmented section.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
Only part of that lowers. So the other part is fixed. There's no rear glass, as we mentioned. And glass is a lot of weight in a car like this.
Yeah, glass is surprisingly heavy.
Okay. My little sidebar that I want to mention here.
Uh-huh.
My little soapbox maybe is that, you know, you see what they can do with some of these materials and make them low and lightweight. But look back at imagine if they could make a car that was 840 pounds. Imagine if there were, you know, these safety features that weigh an additional 900 pounds that they had to add to the car to make it, you know, compatible to whatever federal laws they've got.
Sure.
Imagine if we went back to a time when, you know, you would sign something almost and say, like, I just give up all rights of what happens to me when I buy this vehicle.
I identify the manufacturer.
Yeah, I mean, look back to, like, the buckboard cars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was nothing more than a few planks of wood and an engine, right? And a few wheels.
Yes.
Four wheels. How about
but
that?
But they couldn't go 99 miles per hour.
No, they couldn't.
Either.
But, I mean, here's a super efficient vehicle. If people really, really, truly want to do this, and there's all this legislation in the way, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, not to get totally political about it, but there's nothing you can do about it now. There's a lot of the stuff built in that says you have to have, here in the United States, you have to have seat belts, airbags, traction control, ABS, all these different, you know, systems that take a lot of extra material in the vehicle and causes a lot of this weight to happen or to occur. I don't know. Just imagine what the roadways would be like if, you know, you had these people that could build these one-off cars, you know, that were super lightweight, super efficient, super, you know, more hyper-efficient cars.
It's an interesting question, especially because it's probably going to remain hypothetical, at least in the States and Europe and Canada. However, if we take an international perspective here, it reminds me of our podcast on the Tata Nano.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Tata Nano, the world's cheapest production car, cheapest buy new off the lot production car, is never going to be sold in the United States in the version it's in now.
If it was, it'd be much heavier and much more expensive, right?
Right, because the materials are part of the cost, and the safety is part of the cost and the weight, and that is legally required. So this is an interesting question, and I think it is a valid point. The difference between the XL1 and the L1 is maybe a little bit more regulated than you might think at first glance.
I still really, really like the looks of the XL1, the new version. I really do like it. I've seen a few of the photos. I think they're in currently.
Yeah.
I'm going to date this podcast when we're recording, but they're in Geneva. where they're giving ride and drives to some press members.
Yes.
And there's some photos. There's some great photos of these things, you know, in a train of XL1s on some little, you know, side back street, you know, back street as they're kind of winding their way through the countryside.
I saw that one too.
They look like little spaceships. They're really, really cool. These are neat vehicles. I think they've got a lot going for them. I think that people are going to really like them. Now, unfortunately, they're only going to be sold in Europe at first.
Right.
They're not coming to, well, fortunate for people in Europe, but, you know, they're not scheduled to, or not saying if they're going to release them anywhere else in the world right now.
They haven't committed to anything yet. At the time of this recording, there is no definitive timeline that has officially come out. Now, there are a bunch of analysts who are saying, you know, different predictions and stuff, but we don't really have to mess with
it. No, it's all speculation at this point. And, you know, for now, I'm happy with just a European release and that it's out there. I'm just glad that they brought this project, you know, to completion, that you know, it's actually a road-going vehicle. Now, I know that's going to be like a relatively low production, sort of it's going to be a hand-built process right now. You know, they're going to manufacture each one individually, and, you know, it's going to be, it's not like a coach building situation where they're going to be custom made for everybody. Right. However, there still is quite a bit of work that goes into, I'm sure, making that carbon fiber chassis and body. Mm-hmm. You know, this single piece monocoque can't be something that is quickly done.
But Scott, if this takes off, if Europe loves this thing, then we very well could see some version of it coming to the United States. And I think it's exciting. You know, when I was listening to our previous podcast, and I have to apologize to the listeners, you guys, we walk away from every episode we do with a bunch of stuff we wish we mentioned. And I notice how many times I say, So
I do apologize
for that.
That was way back in the high speed stuff days, right?
Yeah, it is. It was back when our show was called High Speed Stuff, which was quite a while ago. So, while I was listening to this, it inspired me to ask a couple of questions for you, and I wanted to follow up with some things. Scott, first off, you were a little bit, I don't want to say angry, but you were a little bit saddened by the cargo space, or lack thereof.
Oh, really?
In the L1.
Huh.
Yeah, because it's not a huge amount.
There just wasn't a whole lot of space for that, Ben. I mean, when with the tandem seating plus an engine and that real narrow, if you look at the original photos, you'll see that there's not a whole lot of space for anything. But
1.8 cubic feet.
That's it, huh?
Yeah, that's it. It's 1.8 cubic feet.
What is that, like a milk crate?
And then, so I have a quote that you had said earlier, quotation matter.
Oh, no.
I kind of could see myself driving this with a lot less luggage, maybe a trailer or a chase vehicle, which I thought was cool. I had an equally
I don't need to carry a lot of stuff.
No, man, you travel light. That's what people say about you.
I don't know how to take that.
So take it as a compliment. All right, so what do you think of the new design? That's one of my first questions.
I think we've already said I really do like it, not quite as much as the L1, but I do like it. I hope to see it here in the United States. If nothing else, I hope that, you know, I know this will happen. Even though it's going to be released in Europe, someone's going to import one here to the States. I know it'll be around. Mm-hmm. I don't know who will have it, if it's a celebrity, if it's a sports celebrity of some kind, you know, what it will be. But, you know, one thing I was thinking is, if you're in Detroit, there's a chance that you may see one. If there's a VW headquarters in, Detroit, Michigan, north of Detroit. And, you often see a lot of VW products that are, you know, ahead of the release out on the road. So keep your eyes open. You may see one up there or in that area, you know, like northern Indiana, northern Ohio. There's a good chance.
And,
well, what about you? Do you like the current design? What do you think of it versus the old design?
I miss that canopy, man. That canopy to me was the business. That was a cool looking thing. Now, gull wing doors, of course, as an 80s kid, I have to always agree that gull wing doors look cool. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that's legally written into our birth certificates.
So gull wings are close second for you.
Yeah, it's a post Back to the Future thing. But the car itself is pretty cool from a design perspective to me. I'm not the biggest fan of the fender skirts, but...
Well, they're necessary, though, for the slippery design.
Yeah, it's part of the drag prevention. But if the price comes down quite a bit, now, from what they're saying.
Oh, yeah. See, there's only speculation at this point.
There's only speculation. They have not, you're making a great point, they have not officially confirmed any of the speculation. And the speculation has ranged from about 50,000 at the Cutter show to as much as around 100,000.
Oh my gosh, I hadn't heard that. The top I had heard is around 50. Now going back to, like, when we were talking about this in 2009, I think the 2008 estimates were anywhere between like 31,000 and 48,000. So if it's truly, if they're truly talking like 100,000 now at this point, that's a lot of money. But I mean, again, the first car, the first production car to have this monocoque, you know, single piece carbon fiber body, and you know, all these lightweight elements that are added in. I mean, that's race car tech.
Yeah.
In a street car, I could almost see that, you know, the first version of this would be somewhere close to that.
But I couldn't see it being 100,000.
It's a lot of new technology.
It is. I don't want it to be 100,000. Maybe that's what I should say.
Two cylinder hybrid version with, you know, turbo diesel with start stop technology.
Carbon fiber, everything.
You know, yeah. Oh, it's got the 7-speed DSG transmission,
which
the automatic.
Didn't even talk about.
That's all right. It's Volkswagen, the 7-speed automatic, the DSG.
Yeah, and it was in the L1 as well.
Obvious choice for this thing because they wanted to shift as smoothly as possible, you know, on its way up and down.
So in response to the question, I would definitely buy one if the price went down low enough.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to see what kind of aftermarket modifications people make to this. I know this is years down the road. Or maybe it's sooner than we think.
Yeah.
But so the XL1 has, I believe, around a 3-gallon gas tank. Is that correct?
I think that's right.
Maybe I'm approximating here. But isn't that one of the first things somebody's going to mess with?
Maybe. But you know what? That also adds a ton of weight.
It does.
And
fuel is heavy.
And that's the problem. See, now you would compromise your miles per gallon, obviously. So you wouldn't be getting the 261.
Right.
But you'd have a longer range.
But hypermilers will just say, we'll take that extra seat out, you know?
Yeah, which is, yeah, exactly. They'll take the passenger seat out, or, you know, they'll even make it, you know, pare it down even further.
They'll take out all the seats.
Anything unnecessary, which is kind of crazy. I mean, even though it's already pretty limited in weight, I could also see somebody maybe even doing a little bit of a hot rod version of this, you know, with its slippery design, and it wouldn't take a whole lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you put in a strong 4-cylinder engine versus this 2-cylinder that's, you know, a hybrid version.
Not a bad point.
You know, let's say that you got half of the miles that they're saying. Let's say you got 130 miles per gallon.
Still, that's pretty dang good.
That would be not a bad commuting car, and if you wanted a little bit of performance with it, you know, that's the trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like that. Or even if you go to the extreme, you could have, you know, a 6-cylinder if you could get it to fit in there. That's the problem. A lot of this won't fit into the space available because it is a pinched design. You know, in the back, it tapers off.
Which bugs me a little bit, but again, I understand that. The thing is, though, that this vehicle is going to get so much street cred because it is a Volkswagen and because they have met the hype. Now, we know that with hybrid vehicles, it's been difficult sometimes for companies to deliver on their original vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that vision, due to constraints of technology, has to be adjusted. But not so much in this case,
yeah,
huh?
See, I think that this carbon fiber chassis and body thing is huge.
It's big.
I really do. This is a major, major advancement. Because this is exactly the point that has held back all of those hypercars that we talked about in the past, is that you can't quickly, cheaply, efficiently put together a carbon fiber body without, you know, all this massive amount of man labor it takes forever to lay out these panels, like I mentioned. If you ever watch anybody build a carbon fiber panel, and you can watch that online anywhere you want, but it's a lengthy, lengthy process. It takes a lot of time in curing and the coating, and it's very, it takes someone who's a craftsman to do it.
Yeah.
In this case, you know, it's done quickly and sort of an assembly line fashion, more so than it ever has in the past. And I'm excited about not only what Volkswagen can do with this technology on other products in their line, but also kind of the competition that this is going to spawn. Because you know other manufacturers are going to figure out a way to do this. And it won't be long before, you know, we used the Miata for an example before. What if Miata comes out with a carbon fiber body?
Uh-huh.
That's going to up the ante for anybody in that market, you know, to do the same. And the competition is really good for the market.
Yeah, no kidding. I wonder what the prefix will be for cars that have carbon fiber. Will it be the Mazda Miata CF?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. It could be just Miata Carbon Edition or something
like that.
Monte
Carlo CF? I'm kidding.
You know what? It could be because it's not going to be limited to sports cars. They're going to do this on a lot of vehicles because, you know, why not? If you have to get these, you know, seemingly unattainable cafe numbers, why not build great big sedans and luxury vehicles even with carbon fiber, you know, panels and components.
This could be big.
Safer than steel, right? I mean, that's what they say, safer than steel.
Maybe this is the time for us to invest in carbon fiber.
Well, stronger than steel.
Manufacturer.
Fiber. Maybe. I mean, this is amazing. This is really good news, I think, for the entire industry.
And we should also mention that we are grateful for our listeners, each and every one. We will never tell you what to do. We will seldom tell you what to do. But I wanted to squeeze in just a bit of listener mail before we leave.
Sounds good.
Okay. Scott, this is some Facebook mail from our friend Jeff. Now, Jeff is asking a question about our global highway episode when we talked about that idea.
Oh, yeah.
And Jeff says, why not have the global road network be a wholly private endeavor?
Ooh, boy, that's tricky.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I started to write a response to Jeff, and then I thought, how do I get this short enough to not be an obscenely long
thing? Is that any better than it being owned by the principalities or whatever that you're,
or the governments? Because the governments would be sort of like cooperating companies.
Boy, I don't know. This is a really sticky situation, isn't it? With it traveling between countries.
Yeah,
that's what makes this all so difficult. I mean, just the politics of the whole thing. To have it privately owned. Oh my gosh, I can't. Who would have enough money to do something like that to begin with?
I don't know.
Would it be a government?
Maybe.
Not privately owned, though.
Yeah, I think that most of if there are any individuals that would be wealthy enough to do this, they would not be the kind of people to spend money on a boondoggle like that, and B, they probably wouldn't be wealthy enough to do it entirely on their own. I mean, we're talking trillions.
Well, and the entire thing would be a toll road. Right? I mean, it would have to be in order to support itself, right? So, because you can't just say somebody owns this and they just build it for, you know, for the good of the world, I wouldn't think.
That would be cool, but that's a little tough to believe.
No, I mean, because maintenance on this, as we discussed, would be
in the billions.
Incredible. In the billions, yeah, that's right. So it just simply couldn't be. Someone would run out of money within a day.
But what if there were people who owned, what if there was like an adopt-a-highway thing? And people could buy, you know, a couple miles or a couple feet of it.
Multiple owners.
If it were to be a single private company controlling this, then it would be in danger of being a monopoly. And monopolies are not necessarily good for markets.
I think that would be extremely bad. If somebody individually owned a highway that connects all the continents in the world.
Yeah.
I can't imagine the power that person would have. I mean, it seems like you could, you know, shut off and open up corridors as you pleased, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could be like a Bond supervillain.
Yeah, you kind of could be. I mean, you could control the ebb and flow of all of the world's goods, really.
And trap people in those underwater tunnels you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of room for like supervillain type person to do this.
And also, to flip the question here, if it's a wholly public endeavor, if it's entirely government run, that doesn't really fix a lot of those same problems. What we're talking about, if I could be a bit nerdy with you, is something that's kind of like the Ring of Power in Lord of the Rings. It might be a little bit too much power for most people or groups.
Definitely. Even if an individual government owned it. Let's say that the United States. Let's say the United States, because we're here in the States. Let's say that they own all of this, the superhighway, this world-connecting highway. Mm-hmm. You're right. I think it would just be like too much. I don't know. There's no better way to say it than it's just too much power for one group or person to hold.
I do want to say, though, just for the sake of argument, that I think if you and I and our new producer, Noel, and Jeff were the only four owners. I think it would be fine.
It might work out.
Sure, yeah. What, are you making fun of me?
Ah, boy, I don't know. Would, would repairs be made on time?
I think we're going to throw that one to Noel. So, in the meantime, while we're working out our devious plan to rule the world through the use of a global highway, we're going to say thank you to our listeners for listening. We hope that you enjoyed our Slightly Fanboy podcast on the excellent XL1, and you can write to us to tell us more about your experiences or what you think the future of carbon fiber may be. Find us on Facebook, drop us a line on Twitter, or send us a good old-fashioned email at
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.